Another mass grave has been discovered in Canada on the site of a former residential school for Indigenous children. First Nations leaders are calling for the country to address its history.
Canada will be known as the nation who tried to exterminate the First Nations. Now we have evidence.
I'm Carol Hills. The U.S. says it will evacuate thousands of Afghan interpreters before it completes troop withdrawals from the country.
I consider it a moral imperative to take care of those that have served along our side.
Pressure has been mounting to protect those who may be targets of the Taliban when the U.S. military leaves Afghanistan. And talking climate change, net zero emissions. What does that actually mean?
You know, I'm a fan of the bathtub analogy.
Still confused? We got you covered. Ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. You're listening to The World. Today, we begin our program in southern Saskatchewan in Canada, where a large unmarked grave at the site of a former residential school for Indigenous children has been found. Today, Chief Cadmus Delorme of the Cowessess First Nation said there were perhaps as many as 750 graves on the site.
We all must put down our ignorance and accidental racism of not addressing the truth that this country has with Indigenous people. We are not asking for pity, but we are asking for understanding.
This news comes just weeks after a grave containing the remains of 215 children was found on the site of a different defunct residential school in British Columbia. Reporter Emily Schwing is in Alaska, and she's been covering this story. Emily, as many as 750 graves on the heels of another similar discovery. That's just a surprising number.
Yeah, this number is really important, Carol. Canada's Truth and Reconciliation Commission estimates there were anywhere between 4,000 and 6,000 deaths at these residential schools. But there's no way of really knowing for sure. These graves are unmarked, and a lot of times counts weren't kept on paper. Between this discovery and the one in Kamloops earlier this month, that's nearly 1,000 unmarked graves right there. The number is only an estimate, and it could increase in the coming months. At a press conference today, Bobby Cameron, the chief of the Federation of Sovereign Indigenous Nations that represents 74 First Nations in Saskatchewan, said this will be part of Canada's legacy.
Canada will be known as the nation who tried to exterminate the First Nations. Now we have evidence.
Emily, how long did Canada's residential schools operate, and what happened to Indigenous children at these schools?
They were in operation for about a century. Towards the end, they did turn into day schools, and they changed hands back to First Nations. But what happened at these schools prior to that is really horrific, Carol. There are many, many stories of sexual abuse, starvation, physical abuse, deaths, all kinds of really horrific atrocities took place at these schools. We heard today from Florence Sparvier. She's an 80-year-old survivor of the Marivault Residential School in Saskatchewan, and she talked a little bit about her experience there, saying that these memories will always be with her.
We had to learn how to be Roman Catholic. We couldn't say our own little blessings, the way we said it at home. We had our own way of honoring ourselves and Mother Earth in our own homes when we were little. But we had to leave all that after.
Now, there's also the news last weekend that two Catholic churches on First Nation land in British Columbia were burned down. Is there any indication that these two stories are related?
We really don't know for certain that there's a connection here. Investigators aren't saying that they have decided a motive in these two fires, but there's been a lot of anger directed at the Catholic Church for its roles in these schools and what happened there. Many of them were run by the Roman Catholic Church, and Prime Minister Justin Trudeau earlier this month called for an apology from the church. He'd done so back in 2017 in a face-to-face meeting with the Pope at the Vatican.
I think it's going to be a really important moment for all of us, particularly Catholics across the country, to reach out in our local parishes, to reach out to bishops and cardinals, and make it clear that we expect the church to take up an step up and take responsibility for its role in this.
Are there any indications that the Catholic Church will apologize?
Not from the level of the Vatican so far. It's something that people are really hoping for. It's something that both Chief Bobby Cameron and Chief Cadmus Delorme called for again today. Some local archdioceses, including Vancouver, Toronto, Regina, have offered official apologies. They've also offered transparency with respect to access to documents that might provide more of an explanation for why these marked graves exist. But it will take a lot of eyes to ensure that church officials follow up on those promises.
Emily Schwing is a reporter based in Alaska. Thanks, Emily.
Thanks, Carol.
There are many questions as the U.S. prepares to withdraw from Afghanistan after 20 years of war. One is how to protect Afghans who aided U.S. forces and who now fear for their lives as the Taliban regains power. U.S. officials now say a plan is underway to help them. The World's immigration editor, Monica Campbell, has been following the story. Monica, we're talking about Afghans employed by the U.S. forces in Afghanistan. How big of a group are we talking about?
Yeah, all told, the breakdown can come up to at least 80,000 people. And the way to think about it is that there are about 17,000 Afghans who are trying to get U.S. visas. Now, with each one of those applicants comes their families. So when you do the math, it can come up to at least 80,000 people.
It's a sizable number. What do we know about the U.S. plans to bring this group of people to safety?
We know that the pressure is on to announce this plan. We haven't seen anything specific. And in fact, yesterday, during a congressional hearing about the Pentagon budget, General Mark Milley, he's the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, he was asked by members of Congress about this.
We have the military capability to do whatever is directed by the President of the United States with respect to our allies and those that have worked with us. And I consider it a moral imperative to take care of those that have served along our side. We are prepared to execute whatever we are directed.
It was interesting because it seems that the defense officials, at least, are pointing up higher and saying, hey, President Biden, are you going to make this move? We're ready to execute a plan. It seems that they have one in place. Let's get the green light.
This has been an issue for 20 years. Why has it taken so long for this problem to be addressed?
In some ways, it's a normal, long, bureaucratic, heavy visa process. And even more recently, you've seen the U.S. embassy in Kabul closed because of a COVID outbreak. So that's slowed things down. And what you hear from politicians who are wanting to really get these Afghans to safety is we got to wipe away these hurdles and just move people along because the stakes are so high.
So if U.S. officials say they've developed a plan of evacuation, do we know any details about it so far?
We don't know details yet. Meantime, groups who are looking at this are saying there's an urgency. It can take weeks, you know, to put this into place and get people onto planes. At the same time, we are seeing airports in Afghanistan. I mean, we don't know how long some of these airports may be secure places. So it's a very tenuous situation, which I think is why people who have so much at stake in this are wondering, why isn't a plan in place, you know, with just weeks before the U.S. Withdrawal is nearing completion?
And I understand Guam is being mentioned as a place people would be taken to, at least temporarily. Why Guam?
U.S. officials haven't designated any place where people could be evacuated. So I want to make that clear. But many people I speak with point to Guam as a logical place because there's a historical precedent there. There's a U.S. air base there, and it's taken people, for example, going back to 1975, where more than 100,000 Vietnamese were evacuated. They were taken to Guam and they were screened there and then resettled in the United States. So there's a history of Guam being used as a place like this for this purpose.
So in all this, we're talking about one group of people, one group of Afghans who may be moved to a safer place, Afghans who work for U.S. forces. But what does this say about the dire security faced by other Afghans who may not be in line for a U.S. visa?
And that's a very big question. We are talking about one segment of the Afghan population, people who are connected to U.S. forces and thus perhaps connected to people in the military and politicians who can lobby on their behalf. many other people in Afghanistan don't have that type of connection, but can be receiving similar threats in a country that, after many years of war, is no safer. So there's definitely a large question about who will be left out.
The World's immigration editor, Monica Campbell, going over the latest on efforts to protect people in Afghanistan who worked with U.S. forces. Thanks a lot, Monica.
You're welcome.
On the California coast, there's been a big increase in the number of people trying to enter the U.S. by sea. The boats are shoving off just south of the U.S.-Mexico border, often with lots of people and no life preservers. KPBS reporter Max Rivlin-Nadler has more from San Diego on the increase and how it could be tied to a controversial border policy.
The amount of boats smuggling humans or drugs caught by U.S. officials along the California coast has jumped by 93% between 2019 and 2020. So far this year, over 1,200 people have been apprehended while being smuggled at sea. Now the U.S. Border Patrol has launched a new Marine unit. Here's Aaron Heitke, the chief agent for the San Diego sector, at a press conference this week.
San Diego Sector Border Patrol is establishing this Marine unit. Border security is national security, and the United States Border Patrol will use our forward-deployed Border Patrol assets, targeted operations...
In May, three people died after a boat capsized off of San Diego's Point Loma, with survivors scrambling over rocks and tide pools. At least one of the victims had tried to enter the U.S. several times before, but she was turned around by Title 42, a pandemic-era public health law invoked by the Trump administration. It lets U.S. officials automatically turn away migrants and asylum seekers at the border. Kenji Kazuka is a lawyer with Human Rights First, a nonprofit that's monitoring conditions for migrants at the border. They just released a report documenting over 3,000 kidnappings or alleged attacks on migrants since Biden took office in Mexican border cities where they've been made to wait under Title 42. Kazuka says the danger migrants can face forces them to take riskier paths across the border.
Whether it's through the river or trying to swim around the border wall in the ocean, and these are incredibly dangerous journeys. People fall from the border wall and are severely injured. They drown in the river. They drown in the ocean.
This week, Border Patrol's Heitke said the rise in human smuggling by sea had nothing to do with Title 42, even though smuggling increased just as the policy went into effect.
We haven't seen any impact of Title 42 on the increase in maritime activity. The individuals that are coming through in the maritime environment are trying to get away. They're not claiming asylum or credible fear. So we don't see a connection to the two.
Heitke said that more enforcement and infrastructure at the land border was driving smugglers to try other methods. Kazuka disagrees with Heitke's assessment.
Not sure what basis the Border Patrol has to claim that they know the reason that people are coming to the United States. They're not asking people if they have a fear of return to their home country. They're not asking people if they have a fear of return to Mexico. They have literally no idea why people are coming to the United States.
In San Diego, Border Patrol agent Curtis Contura shows off the new boats, which are part of the new unit. The two boats were originally built to patrol the shallow waters of the Rio Grande. They're not made for the ocean, so their role when it comes to enforcement will be pretty limited.
We are a first response platform. We do have first aid that we can render. We have emergency extraction flotation devices so we can get people out of the water to safety.
Late Sunday night, the Coast Guard intercepted a 27-foot skiff off the coast of San Diego. It was running without its lights on to avoid detection. 20 people were on board, including people from Mexico, Guatemala, and El Salvador. They were taken into Border Patrol custody. Border Patrol has not yet said whether they were sent back to Mexico. For The World, I'm Max Rivlin-Nadler in San Diego.
You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. The idea of net zero in climate policy didn't really exist a decade ago. Now it's the official goal of international efforts to tackle the climate crisis.
We are committed to net zero.
To net zero emissions.
Net zero greenhouse gas emissions by 2050.
An estimated 1 in 5 of the world's largest companies have these targets, and over the past few years, 131 countries have set or started considering net zero policies. That includes European Union countries.
This proposal sets in stone our objective to be climate neutral in 2050.
China.
We aim to have carbon neutrality before 2060.
And the U.S.
These steps will set America on a path of net zero emissions economy by no later than 2050.
But what does net zero actually mean, and where did this target come from? That's today on The Big Fix.
change is coming.
Can we turn this around?
We have no other option.
What we do now will profoundly affect the next few thousand years.
Today, on our weekly dive into climate solutions, the world's environment correspondent Carolyn Beeler digs into the promise and peril of net zero.
If you have had only a fuzzy idea of what net zero means,
you know, I'm a fan of the bathtub analogy.
Taryn Franson, a senior fellow at the World Resources Institute, has a good way of explaining it.
So we can think of the atmosphere like a bathtub, where out of the faucet are coming all of the greenhouse gases that we emit.
From things like driving and heating our homes and flying in planes.
And going down the drain are all of the greenhouse gases that we absorb either in forests or through carbon removal technology or whatever else it might be.
Net zero is where the water level in the bathtub stays the same. The carbon we release is balanced out by what gets sucked up. The idea of net zero started gaining traction a few years before the 2015 UN Climate Summit in Paris. Former World Bank climate envoy Rachel Kite says some of the Paris Agreement's architects argued that the climate talks, they needed an overarching goal.
We need to know the point on the horizon to which we will be traveling. And then working back from that, then we need to know how ambitious we have to be in the next 5 years and in the next 10 years, etc.
Kite was introduced to the idea of net zero at a gathering of powerful women leaders at a stately private home in Scotland.
So we were pulled together in the summer of 2013. It was a gorgeous weekend. And we were talking about the road to Paris. And I remember being called into the kitchen and a number of activists, they were like, what would you think if we said that the goal is getting to zero?
Zero, but not quite. Renewable energy at the time was more expensive than it is today. And Kite says it was difficult to imagine how things like steel or concrete could be produced without carbon emissions.
The idea that we were going to be producing emissions for quite some time. So emissions are going to go up, but you've got to balance them off. You've got to be net zero rather than zero.
Kite went on to advocate for the idea at the World Bank. When the Paris Climate Change Agreement was gaveled in December of 2015,
je n'entends pas d'objection. L'accord de Paris pour le climat est accepté.
A global net zero target was written into it, though in quite a few more words. And in 2018, a UN science report backed up what had until then been a political goal. It found that reaching net zero carbon emissions by mid-century was essential to keeping global warming below 1.5 degrees Celsius. And Kite, who is now the dean of the Fletcher School at Tufts University, says the idea has been embraced much more widely than expected.
We have a political alignment from Beijing to Brussels to Washington, with all kinds of points in between, aligned to net zero commitments around about 2050. That's an extraordinary global platform of understanding that we never had before.
The science behind net zero is today pretty settled. But as the popularity of setting net zero targets has increased, skepticism has grown too. Scientist James Dyke has emerged as a critic.
The general problem with net zero policies, as they have evolved quite recently, is that they are effectively licensing a burn now, pay later approach.
Burn now, pay later, says Dyke, who's assistant director of the Global Systems Institute at the University of Exeter.
By including future removals in your climate policies, you're essentially allowing policymakers or corporations, governments, businesses to not make the required emissions reductions that we need now.
Instead of cutting energy use and switching to renewables, Dyke says some targets rely on
miraculous machines that are going to appear sometime over the next few decades.
In other words, facilities that capture emissions from power plants or suck them right out of the air and store them. These do exist, but not at any kind of scale. Planting trees, on the other hand, is a proven way to remove lots of carbon dioxide from the air. But that solution raises fears of land grabs, says Teresa Anderson, climate policy coordinator with ActionAid International.
We know that smallholder farmers, indigenous peoples, women, these are the ones that are going to lose their lands, their livelihoods, their sources of food.
Her group is critical of a net zero plan recently released by Shell. It calls for offsets of 120 million metric tons of emissions a year by 2030. It would take a forest the size of Montana in the U.S. to offset that much carbon. That's by my very rough estimate.
If you add it all up, you realize that there just isn't enough land on the planet for all the trees that would be needed to offset the continued pollution that's assumed in all these hundreds or possibly thousands of corporate and government net zero targets.
I asked Taryn Franson, the expert with the bathtub analogy, to respond to these criticisms. She says they're built around a concern that countries and companies are going to rely too much on the drain, removing carbon from the atmosphere.
So we're going to just keep those emissions gushing out of the faucet and somehow make a really huge drain that will let all of that water or all of those greenhouse gases out. And that's net zero mathematically. But that's not the only way we can do net zero. We can also turn down the faucet very significantly and get away with having only a little trickle going out the drain.
For instance, by getting off of coal, making homes more energy efficient, and switching to electric cars. Most countries will be rolling out their short-term roadmaps toward net zero ahead of the UN climate summit this November. People like Franson will be going over them with a fine-toothed comb.
So I think what we need to be doing when governments and others are setting this net zero target is saying, great, how are you going to get there? What are you doing today and tomorrow that is different because you have a net zero target than it would be if you didn't have that net zero target?
Franson says she will be looking for specific near-term action in these plans, absolute carbon reduction targets, not just the net zero part, and real reductions at home, not just tons of trees planted abroad. A target is just a point on the horizon, after all. What matters is actually getting there. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
An agreement with Iran that allows international experts to monitor some of its nuclear activities expires today. Many observers worry that if the agreement isn't renewed, it will make the talks over the Iran nuclear deal even harder to resolve. Read more about this in our newsletter. Sign up at theworld.org/newsletters. A talented singer always wanted to learn more about her family's Jewish heritage.
I knew I came from this wonderful culture, but I always wanted more. There were so many stories and bits of language that I just craved.
So she made an album that turned into a community effort in North Macedonia. Hear how it turned out later on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH and PRX. After a year-long postponement, we are now just under 1 month from the start of the Summer Olympics in Tokyo. This week, people around the world are marking the occasion with Olympic Day celebrations, where organizers honor, quote, the irresistible power of the Olympics to unite people, communities, and societies across the globe. But this year, the celebrations are competing for attention with protests against the Games. The World's Bianca Hillier reports.
On streets around the world, Olympic Day celebrations are being met with no Olympic Day rallies, like this one in Tokyo. Transnational support for cancellation is strong. Solidarity actions have popped up in Paris, South Korea, Berlin, Sydney, and New Zealand. In Los Angeles, anti-Olympics organizers read a statement sent from activists in Japan. It was also translated to English for the crowd.
It's unimaginable how badly the Japanese government and Tokyo's government want to hold the Olympics during this pandemic.
Anne Orchier is a member of the No Olympics LA group.
We want to draw attention to the demands and the experience of our comrades in Tokyo. We want to highlight how they've already suffered.
This opposition to the Olympics isn't new. Orchier and her fellow international organizers say the destruction began long before the coronavirus.
If there had been no pandemic, there still would be so many people who were displaced because of the Olympics. There still would be so many people who had to face some really intense state violence and enhanced policing in Japan because of the Olympics.
COVID-19, she added, has only expanded that circle of harm. Still, the International Olympic Committee has been unwavering in its pursuit to hold the Games this summer. With just 29 days to go, there's no real sign of a change in plans. And for people set to attend the Games, the lack of safety precautions in place is a cause for concern.
Well, it makes me all just always very sad.
Barbara Holthus lives in Japan and is set to volunteer at both the Olympics and Paralympics this summer. She says volunteers have been sent some e-learning courses about how to protect themselves from COVID at the Games. But when she went to pick up her uniform, she wasn't impressed.
We were given two cloth masks in Olympic blue. And before that, we had already been mailed a PDF that we could print out where we write in our well-being. We're supposed to measure our temperature for 14 days before we actually start our shift.
Holthus and the other 70,000 volunteers are being asked to self-monitor for COVID-19 before entering the stadiums. Then I asked if proof of vaccination is required.
There's not even the option to be vaccinated for the large majority of us.
Despite nearly a million jabs now being administered daily throughout the country, less than 10% of residents are fully vaccinated, according to Johns Hopkins. Holthus says there's also been no word of any COVID-19 testing for on-site volunteers. What they will get is a small personal bottle of hand sanitizer at the start of each shift.
But that is it. Nothing else. That's extraordinarily inadequate.
Holthus's particular volunteer assignment will have her directly interacting with spectators. This week, Olympic organizers said venues will be allowed to be at 50% capacity, up to 10,000 people. The announcement put Holthus on edge.
Of course, the number 10,000 makes you like, oh no, I don't want to be anywhere around 10,000 people.
Those people are being asked to be on their best behavior. Tokyo organizers said yesterday there will be no alcohol, no hugs, no cheers, and no autographs allowed in the stands. Holthus has been looking forward to volunteering for years. She has even researched the Olympics as a sociologist. But if she shows up to her shift and doesn't feel comfortable, she won't hesitate to go home. And she expects other volunteers will do the same. For the World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
It's been called Africa's hidden war, and it's increasingly difficult to find out exactly what's going on there. I'm talking about the brutal conflict that's been raging since November in Ethiopia's Tigray region, where government forces are trying to disarm their political rivals. Yesterday, dozens of shoppers were reportedly killed and many others injured after Ethiopia's Air Force bombed a busy market. Details of the bombing are hard to pin down because soldiers have reportedly blocked medical teams from traveling to the scene. Alex DeWall directs the World Peace Foundation at Tufts University. He says Ethiopian authorities are tightening a curtain around Tigray's starving civilians.
This huge war has been raging for 7 months, and famine conditions have been created, not by any natural disaster, but by the deliberate action, the deliberate starvation inflicted by the Ethiopian government and its coalition partner from neighboring Eritrea. And yet, astonishingly, we have had no news reporting about the extent of the battles, no pictures of the starving children. And this is exactly what the Ethiopian government wants. It wants to be able to inflict these atrocities in complete darkness, in complete silence, without global outcry from the conscience of the world.
Alex, you follow this topic closely. How do you get your information?
I speak to people on the ground, Tigrayans on both sides, and I get confidential reports. No aid worker dare speak out openly for fear of being expelled from the country or even worse. So earlier today, I was speaking to a close colleague who is in the rebel-held areas, and he described how over the last week, the Tigrayan resistance has actually achieved a remarkable and astonishing military success. They wiped out no fewer than 5 full divisions. That's nearly half the combat capacity of the Ethiopian army. And that account is actually confirmed by a number of independent analysts. And the reason for this bombing attack on the market at Togoga is that as the government forces are forced to withdraw to just one major city in Tigray, they are beginning to unleash a campaign of vengeance. And the one thing they control is the air. So they are bombing civilian targets as a form of punishment and intimidation. Actually, there's something else they control, which is the humanitarian access. And I fear what we're going to see is very large rural areas controlled by the Tigrayan resistance being encircled and blockaded, and the government of Ethiopia and its Eritrean allies trying to force the people of Tigray into submission through starvation.
But I should add, the UN at this point says both sides are guilty of abuses and atrocities.
So there have been 120-odd massacres documented, of which two are by the resistance, all the others by the Eritreans and Ethiopians. The UN reported 131 blockages of humanitarian aid. One was by the resistance. The other 130 were by the Ethiopians and Eritreans. So all sides are responsible, but it is not a symmetrical responsibility.
Regarding this marketplace bombing, what do we know about what actually happened?
We don't know that much. We know that scores were killed, and we know that ambulances were prevented from evacuating the wounded to the hospitals in the nearby city of Mekele. I've had reports from medical staff at the main hospitals that they tried to save the lives of grievously injured children, and they were not able to do that because access was blocked.
Is this a case of the Ethiopian government ordering an airstrike on its own people?
The Ethiopian government has, sadly, a history of doing this. It is the only one with aircraft, and it does look like a war crime, a crime in which a civilian marketplace was targeted by Air Force aircraft with bombs.
Alex DeWall is the executive director of the World Peace Foundation at Tufts University. He's been talking with us about the ongoing fighting in Ethiopia's Tigray region. Thanks a lot, Alex.
Thank you so much.
The White House announced today that it's barring the import of solar panel materials from several Chinese companies based in Xinjiang in western China. The Biden administration says it's an effort to stamp out modern-day slavery in supply chains. About 45% of the global supply of the silicon used in solar panels comes from Xinjiang, where Uyghurs are often forced to work and face other human rights abuses. To understand the supply chain side of this story, we turn to David Feldman at the National Renewable Energy Laboratory. David, can you tell us a bit more about what exactly was banned today? Is it just the silicon or additional manufactured parts?
Right now, the current ruling blocks metallurgic grade silicon and then certain products from companies that make that silicon into something else used for solar PV production, which is polysilicon.
What do we know so far about how China is using forced labor in producing silicon?
I can tell you that the U.S. has concluded that forced labor is being used on a variety of products made in Xinjiang. Previously, there's been rulings against cotton, so stuff for clothing and tomatoes and other things. And this current ruling today is concerning polysilicon, which is the key ingredient for solar. I can tell you that the Chinese government disputes these claims.
This ban of silicon from China, it's one step the U.S. government can take to make sure that we're not buying things made with forced labor. But are there other steps that we could be taking?
The impact right now is relatively muted in the sense that we don't actually import a lot of goods from these companies to the U.S. market directly. These products are made, produced, and sold to companies that then turn these into products that we buy. So the next stage could be banning products with material used by these companies, and that would have a much larger impact.
What are the other countries that have silicon that could be part of the supply chain now?
Sure. Well, the U.S. has significant manufacturing capacity for polysilicon, as does Germany and South Korea. There's also significant polysilicon manufacturing outside of Xinjiang in China. And then the question becomes, are there protocols in place to guarantee that the supply chain that folks are interested in are getting the products from the Chinese provinces that are acceptable versus the ones that the U.S. government believes uses forced labor?
Can marketplace and supply chain issues be an effective way to apply pressure on human rights issues, or is it kind of too complicated?
Certainly, companies and governments have used trade policies and product decisions, like corporations using ESG-type goals and policies, to affect the way markets operate. For example, solar industry, a significant significant amount of manufacturing capacity of modules and cells is now located in other parts of Asia, particularly Southeast Asia, in part because of trade policies enacted against China. There's also significant module assembly now in the U.S., in part because of trade practices. So certainly those things can happen.
You mentioned ESG. What does that mean?
ESG is environment and social governance. Basically, corporations care about the environment, social being socially responsible, environmentally responsible. And so, you know, there are a lot of protocols being set up in place in the solar industry. And while those things certainly could and may be important parts for the government, they certainly provide a good roadmap for corporations beyond what the government policies are.
Do you think we can get to a point where U.S. consumers can feel good about using solar power and where the components of that solar power comes from?
I think so. I think that there are tools out there to help U.S. consumers have a better understanding of supply chain for the products that they're buying. And certainly part of the administration's goal of having a more sustainable electricity infrastructure in the U.S. and having more good-paying jobs, there's a possibility for manufacturing domestically. It's just about putting the right policies in place.
David Feldman is a researcher with the National Renewable Energy Laboratory and focuses on renewable energy policy. Thanks so much for your time, David.
Thank you.
Spanish authorities say everything points to death by suicide as they launch an investigation into the case of John McAfee. The software security pioneer was found dead in a prison outside Barcelona yesterday, hours after a Spanish court ruled that he could be extradited to the U.S. on tax evasion charges. McAfee was a millionaire, a fugitive, an innovator, and even a one-time presidential candidate. Steve Morgan knew John McAfee well. He's the founder of the market research firm Cybersecurity Ventures. Steve, a lot of people know the name McAfee from antivirus software on their computers. What did John McAfee represent in the world of cybersecurity?
He was one of the founding fathers of our industry at a time very early on where we didn't even use the term cybersecurity. He came to market with one of the first commercial pieces of software that was used globally to combat viruses, which were the biggest threat at the time.
How did you meet and later get to know John McAfee?
So in 2016, after writing a series of articles about John, he asked me to write his biography. And I was hesitant to do that because John is known for, frankly, lying or, you know, sharing, you know, multiple versions of the truth. And I wasn't comfortable taking on a project of that magnitude without meeting him in person, getting to know him better. So I did go down. I met with John for a couple of days and then spent several months after that following up with him and other people.
What was he like to be around?
When I first met him at an incubator in Alabama, he was accompanied by a security guard. I don't think he needed that guard. And the guard had a piece. I don't think he needed that.
You mean a gun?
Yes. So John was very paranoid. He was always worried, always concerned that somebody was out to get him, somebody was conspiring against him. That broke down after we spent some time with each other. And in 8 or 9 hours in that first day together, he opened up and he spoke to me very frankly about his childhood, about his family, about starting up McAfee, and the rest of his life.
You were hired to do his biography, but you didn't in the end. Why not?
I didn't want to be associated with a lot of what I learned about John. I was very uncomfortable with subject matter having to do with minors, having to do with sex, having to do with drugs. I just was concerned that my company would just be too closely branded and aligned with him. Left off with John that I was not going to write the biography. He was upset, but we did agree that I would publish some articles and blogs and do my best to tell his story because he wanted the story told.
How would you describe his later years? What kind of life was he leading as compared to the early success and being kind of the toast of the town?
You know, I think he was always troubled. I directly asked John, "Do you suffer from mental illness?" And he very directly said, "No, absolutely not." My takeaway, though, personally, is that he did and that he was deeply disturbed. I do know that he was on a lot of medication. And I don't say that in a critical way. I say that with a lot of sympathy. John had a very troubled childhood. His father beat him mercilessly as a young boy. When John was 15 years old, his father committed suicide. And I don't think John ever got past that.
I know McAfee had a very kind of colorful and unusual and controversial life, but should he be remembered as a pioneer in cybersecurity?
I think he should be. That is who he is. There were definitely multiple dimensions to John, but in my opinion, none of that takes away from the fact that he truly was a technologist and a pioneer and one of the early movers in the industry.
Steve Morgan is the founder of the market research firm Cybersecurity Ventures. He's been talking with us about the life and legacy of John McAfee. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Songs are stories. To musician Sarah Aroeste, the songs on her new album, Monastir, tell stories of the lost Jewish community in the Balkan city with the same name. Today, it's known as Bitola in the country of North Macedonia. Musician Sarah Aroeste joins us from her home in Western Massachusetts. Sarah, you've done quite a lot of research about Jewish life in Monastir, and I understand this started out as a personal quest for you.
It did. You know, I have a very typical immigrant story, not unlike many others listening, I imagine, that my family came to America escaping war. In their case, it was the Balkan Wars in 1912, and they really wanted to leave the old country behind. So I knew I came from this wonderful culture, but I always wanted more. There were so many stories and bits of language that I just craved, and my relatives either didn't want to talk about it or they had forgotten some of the traditions, and I always felt like I was missing something.
And what about music? How did that become the way in?
Well, I always grew up as a musician, and I'd heard some of the Ladino folk songs growing up. Ladino is the language of my family. It's the Sephardic dialect, and it's this beautiful hybrid language that was always so mysterious to me, but it was the first language of my grandfather and all of my relatives from Monastir, and I always wanted to learn more. And for me, music was the way to do so. I spent years studying the Ladino traditional repertoire, and I just fell in love with it. It just added so much texture to the mysterious world that I'd heard of from my grandfather's generation.
Now, I know one of the songs on your album honors a relative. Let's hear a bit of the song, and then I want you to tell us about it. What's the song about?
So I wrote this song. It's one of two original songs on the album. And I wrote it from memories taken from my own grandfather and his first cousin, my dear, dear cousin, Rochelle, who is still alive. She's turning 104 years old this year. And because of her, I have these wonderful images and stories that she has shared with me, along with my own grandfather, who was born in Monastir and who I got to know for much of my life. He died in his 90s. And so I wrote this song about the sounds and the smells and the textures of Monastir to honor my grandfather and my cousin Rochelle.
I know your knowledge of them led you to research and record your new album in Bitola, in what used to be called Monastir. Before we get to that, though, what happened to the Jewish community in the city?
So we don't really think of Macedonia when we think of World War II, but in fact, the city of Monastir had one of the highest percentages of Jews exterminated. 98% of the Jewish population was murdered, and only 2% survived, one of which was my dear cousin Rochelle.
So your album became a personal exploration of your family's background, but also an exploration of a community that was lost.
Yes, Monastir is a beloved city to many, many Jews scattered around the world today. So I knew it was bigger than just my own family. So I wanted to find songs and stories that really could encompass a wide swath of what life was like before World War II. I wanted young voices, old voices, female voices, male voices. I wanted stories from the Jewish side, stories from the non-Jewish side. And it was really sort of like putting together a puzzle to create the 10 tracks that make up this album. We also wanted a mixture of languages. I have Macedonian songs, Hebrew songs, Ladino songs, and every single song was so purposefully curated to tell a story that shows a snapshot into what life was like for the Jewish community before World War II. One of my favorite tracks on the album is of a non-Jewish man who is a bachelor, and he wanders into the Jewish quarter where he finds a beautiful, lovely girl, and he tries to convince her to become Slavic, which I just think is an amazing song. Even though it's in Macedonian and it is from a non-Jewish perspective, it just shows so much about Jewish life from that time long ago.
Битола, а си тргнав на прошетка во битола. Лайла, лайла, лала, лала, лай, на прошетка во битола. Лайла, лайла, лала, лала, лай, на прошетка во битола.
It's so interesting that you recorded the album in Bitola and that the residents there were so involved. It sounds like you learned a lot from them and they learned a lot from you.
It's true. It was really because of the non-Jewish community that invited me and proved to me through my travels there over the past few years that they are on the ground doing the work to preserve Jewish history there today. And I was just completely blown away by their commitment and respect for this culture. And that's really what inspired me to move forward with this project.
Sarah Aroeste's new album is called Monastir. It comes out tomorrow. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bell Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Carol Hills. Thanks for listening, and see you back here tomorrow.
From PRX.